This is Teams?
Yeah. If you want to open the theory, you can see the difference. So this is the graph that hits you in the eye. And that's it.
And now just to circle, just different technical difficulties, because maybe there is some other thing. So at least one concept in the next year.
Yeah.
No!
Vous avez une intégration liquide sans deux photons. Donc en reconstruisant l'énergie de deux photons, on peut trouver la masse de l'objet d'où ils sont venus, n'est-ce pas, ces deux photons. C'est un calcul élémentaire d'ajouter les deux énergies au carré. Vous enlevez la somme d'impulsions au carré et vous avez la masse au carré. Donc c'est ça que vous avez ici, c'est la racine carrée de tout ça, en fait, parce que vous avez simplement la masse. Donc, vous avez un Higgs en deux photons ici, mais ce n'est pas seulement le Higgs qui s'appelle cette intégrale de photons. Vous pouvez avoir plein de choses qui, par exemple, mettent un photon par-ci et un photon, et un autre, un photon par-là. Donc, ça fait un bruit de fond aléatoire qui est chou, qui n'est pas, en fait, c'est. Même s'il n'y avait pas de Higgs, il y aurait, parce que c'est vraiment le bruit de fond. Donc une fois que vous faites ça, vous avez cette petite bombe qui ne paraît pas très impressionnant, ça ne tape pas à l'œil, mais effectivement, si vous connaissez très bien votre bruit de fond, vous comparez, donc par rapport au bruit de fond, la comparaison de la ce qu'on appelle théorie, ce n'est pas théorie, c'est vraiment le calcul du bruit de fond, c'est à zéro, et là, vous voyez que par rapport à cela, il y a, vous voyez, c'est 500 événements, c'est pas trivial, c'est pas toi un événement, c'est un bombe, sorte de, qui est la preuve, on peut le voir.
Si. I don't understand the negative effects.
I don't understand how we can have negative events outside the robot.
Because you have subtracted a number. The number of your
here, for instance, here your background is 8,000. You measure here some, and you subtract from your background. You see this red goes a little bit above this black dot. Or let's take something here. Here you see your red curve in the prediction is 6,000 and something, and you measure that. So then you subtract the two, and it is negative with respect to the 6,000 that you should have. But still compatible, it is of course 1.5 sigma.
It's
very statistically, it says zero, and you have above and below, and this is many sigma. This is at least four, and another four, eight, and five sigma is considered a discovery in the past few days. So it is 10 sigma, 6, 10 sigma, or something.
Probably combining Atlas and CNN, the process very.
So, did you roughly understand?
Yeah, you for sure. But okay, you for sure. You, great. The rest, okay. Enjoy the taste of the coffee. So, yes?
What's about the notation of the y axis? Events over.
It is your bit. You bit, you measure every 2 GeV,
okay.
The number of events.
It's a meaning, yes.
You have 5 bits between 100 and 110.
Because the number of events, imagine, for example, you have 4 events with 4.1 GeV and 1 event.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So, more questions about this? Okay, I'm putting here because before you asked me to have a plot where we could see the excess, right? So this is the reason why I'm putting the plot here.
So I just have a final question. We see at 7-10, we had a certain, I think it's of Fermi bounds, one of the Fermi bounds.
Okay, okay, just a second, because if you speak in jargon, nobody will follow you. So what does it mean, Fermi bar? What does it mean?
No, I was saying, so we have the 8-10, which was the highest luminosity before we shut down the LHC. So now we are at 13-10. So by how much the luminosity has increased? Do you know of the recent run that we have been doing over the last few months?
Yes. Now, okay. Just to translate a bit the example, probably, no? First, 7 TV, 8 TV is the energy with which you are colliding the proton antiproton. Okay. This was still 1 year ago. Okay. No. Oh. Okay. Okay. Till 1 year ago. Yeah. And now they're increasing the energy of the collision. They're going to 14, 13 TeV. Okay. So this is the first one. This number. Then he was speaking about luminosity. Luminosity means the number of events you are collecting. The number of collisions you have, okay? Clearly, not all collisions can produce the Higgs. Okay, so here you have a collection of Fugu minus one, thanks to bar, right? Is a way to measure the luminosity. So here it is saying that you produce this quantity of collision, proton-antiproton collisions. Of, for example, in this beam, this position of around 10 GeV. Okay, here you see that you have around 7,000 events producing two photons with an energy of 110 GeV. So I repeat, for putting together all events that was produced at LHC at Atlas before 2012, okay, you have in this case 7,000 events with an energy which is of the photons, total energy of the photons, 110 GeV. Okay. So this is to explain the jargon. Then the luminosity that are now, it's
the integrated luminosity for the time, because this is integrated, how many you gather, since it really started very recently, in summer. Must not be more than, I don't know, two, three university pentobar. Much less. But you have an advantage by the fact that you run twice the energy. The cross section, what we say, the probability to produce the Higgs is higher by a factor 2 to 3 already because you are at higher energy. So that compensates somehow. But they're gathering statistics.
Yeah. What I remember from the books of the experiment is in September we will start to have enough events to start having new analysis and to have new constraints. Okay? Data that are more interesting than this one.
Okay.
But actually, if you want to the gossip, the problem is that SCMS, they have a problem with the magnetic field. So in order to reconstruct the tracks of the particles, the charged particle, you have a magnetic field, right? Because Lorentz force rotates. And in CMS, it seems that they have some problem with the magnetic field. So there.
Yeah. About
sure.
The so the background is all the other processes that
yes.
Okay. Gamma gamma. But the only one that we found is the gamma.
Yeah. Okay. If I understood correctly the question, I can try to repeat it. Tell me. So here, here you are measuring events where you have two photons, right? Photons that come from the same variable. So typically, clearly you are seeing these photons, but you don't know if they come from a given interaction or a certain different interaction. You're just counting the number of dipotons here.
So if your here this line without the bumper, the dashed line corresponds to this written here background, okay? Which means that it is what the number of events you said in the case that there is no hit.
But he asked something else, I think.
Ah, sorry.
Let me reply.
You see here that you are between 100 and 160 GeV. If you went, for instance, down, if it was possible, you would have billions and zillions of photons. If you go to 140 MeV, you have a huge resonance, which is a pi zero. Two photons, I mean. And then if you went around, 1 GeV, you would have other resonances, the rows and omegas, etc., etc. But they don't look there because, okay, this what Feynman said is the things we know, and we don't expect anything new there. So they, this, there are many better photons that go from zero to, let's say, 300 GeV. And here there is a focus on the area we knew. And actually, we were expecting there. This is the beauty of GeV zero.
Yes.
More questions? But maybe we have to move. But if you have questions are more important than blah blah blah, my blah blah blah. No questions.
Full screen.
Okay. So we are right here, and
we can read the facts that we know, right? Because at the beginning I said we start with fact, what we think that is completely true, and then we extrapolate and we start to understand more. So to summarize, what we know is, okay, with this machine,
LAC,
raw.
Okay, with LAC, what we are able to do, okay, is to explore the energy up to 1 GeV. 1,000 times the energy of the energy that is stored in the proton. So, but at LAC, we are just reproducing some high energy, but we are not able to reproduce the density and the temperature that was present in the older universe. Okay, so since we have experimented that exploring only this part, temperature and density, okay, we don't know what is going on when at this energy you are also adding a temperature and density. Okay. This is important because depending on these issues, you have a different history of the universe before this time. What we know, moreover, is that we have many particles, but they can be embedded very well in negative theory. We have the quarks, these are the quarks, and we have the electrons. Here you don't see, because there should be a color in the background, but the colors, the quarks are interacting with all these bodies. The electrons, for example, are interacting with the photon, with the positron, and the boson, but not with the gluon. And so, moreover, we know that in order to, in a case theory, to have to explain the mass of these particles, you need you need a new particle, the Higgs boson. And this boson was discovered 3 years ago. Okay, this one. Moreover, we have understood, I hope, that the larger interaction with the Higgs boson, the larger the mass. A key issue in order to explain the mass is that the Higgs boson needs to have a peculiar potential, because we said in the analogy with the harmonic oscillator, we said that the harmonic oscillator has to move around a minimum which is not the one at zero, it's the same one. In this case, in the equation of motion, you could replace the presence of the Higgs just by putting one constant there. And this constant is what reproduces the mass. But, okay, it's a fact that we don't know how this potential was in the universe. So how this potential changes when you put the temperature and density. Moreover, you don't know, we don't know, the behavior of this potential far away from what I thought. For example, here, does it go like that? Does it go like that? Does it go like that? And so on. So the behavior of this potential is unknown
in effect
when the universe was very hot, and it's also not known what happens to the behavior of this potential when we are going far away from the scale that we can see. Okay, which means that x is not very clear.
So we can start the second part, which is inferring and speculating, right? From the fact.
So, since we are in Greece, we like this. Okay. Right. So, we start again, okay, with the Plato. The Plato's allegory.
Do you remember the allegory? Yes? No?
Okay. I deform it, I oversimplify it again in order to give you the idea. Okay? There is the sun. Okay, here. Okay, these guys are captives in a cave, and they are forced to watch only what happens here on the wall. Outside the cave
there is the sun,
and the sun. Okay, same thing. But you can see the sun also only here. Okay, there might be
a fire,
and the fire is producing some shadows here. So,
what we are experiment that in the union.
The experiment that we do to understand the universe actually are shadows here. Okay? And clearly what we do is that we try to explain them as much as possible, but in order to really, whatever you can do is to have indirect measurement of what happened here. The best that we can do is to go away and to try to walk here and to see the sun. So, in cosmology,
since we have just one universe and the energy is so high that we cannot reproduce it,
we are looking at shadows. In principle, by having collided machines or direct detection experiment, you can move away and you can probe energies that otherwise you cannot test. But clearly, for that, you need to walk and it's an effort. Right? And in particular,
in principle, you cannot go in energy so to very high energy like the ones of the really beginning of the universe.
Okay.
This was a very long story since you were Greece, I wanted to put an example on this.
Okay. So what we do is we make some assumptions, we use the Higgs boson and its potential, and we try to by using math to understand if the Higgs potential can solve some big problems in cosmology. And here, clearly, since we have only indirect effect, what we do is we try to use some assumptions, and we check the prediction of these assumptions. Okay. So, and if from these assumptions we can predict new features that after the experiment we'll test, wonderful. Our trust in assumptions increases. Clearly, if they need us to make a prediction. And here, this is okay. I was in when I did this slide. I was in the philosophical moon. Do you know this guy?
Oh, okay. I didn't. Popper. Do you know Popper? Karl Popper.
Yeah. Okay. Let's say that he
would have some troubles with this sentence. Okay. But in any case, Popper was the. If you are bored at some point, at least checking Wikipedia or something like that, and Karl Popper. Popper, a bit because it's German, Austrian.
So,
in order to understand one problem in cosmology, we go back in time, and this time, okay, in the first part, I was putting a lot of importance to experiments, right? But okay, theorists are there, I can do something. And sometimes they can make wonderful predictions that can be tested only later on. So, one very bright mind was Paul Dirac. Okay? In this period, before 1928, there was an issue. You could have quantum mechanics, where you could explain a phenomena occurring at very, very high energy and at very high speed. Okay? And you have Schrödinger and Heisenberg that had quantum mechanics. The point is that there was no way to make quantum mechanics compatible with special relativity, and vice versa. So Dirac was a guy who understood something, right? He said, okay, let's start to write a kind of equation, doesn't matter the explicit meaning of the equation, and if I'm using this equation, I'm predicting that the particles, some particles, have a behavior that corresponds to this equation, again, a kind of Lagrangian that I gave before for the harmonic oscillator. Okay. In this case, I can explain very, very well all the something important, that the problem of the time, that was to explain the orbits in the hydrogen atom. The important point is that if you use this equation, you have a prediction. And this prediction is that you don't have only fermions, only, let's say, leptons, but you have also anti-leptons. Because whenever you try to put, for example, an electron here, this represents an electron, okay, you have that there are some part that is electron. But I should, you predict also that there is a second solution, a second, you cannot avoid that there is also a second state. So, by this equation, you can solve some big problems, big problem, but you have a prediction. You cannot avoid this. This prediction is that there are four states for this fermion. Okay? There are two with negative charge and two with positive charge. Okay? So, if there is an electron, you need also to have an electron with the same mass, but with charge. The opposite charge. So if the electron is minus one, the anti-electron, you bring an anti-electron, which are plus one. This anti-electron is called positron. So, as I say, okay, it was again a problem, right? Because you have a solution that provides a wonderful explanation of the hydrogen atom, better than one part in a million. So you have to imagine that before, the point of having the special relativity not compatible with quantum mechanics made your prediction completely wrong about the orbit. So, and then after some years, we have this guy who found this antiparticle, the antielectron, the positron. So again, it was the same strategy. You use a cloud chamber, what I explained before, the one with the superheated gas and so on. And you check, and you have that in the cosmic rays, you see some tracks. These tracks, okay,
do you see the pointer?
No. Okay. Here you have the track of the something coming from the space, the sky. And you have a particle with the mass of the electron going here, and a particle with the same radius, I said the radius, from the radius you can deduce the mass, going the opposite direction. This means that, okay, opposite charge, but the same mass. So, in 1932, Carl Anderson discovered the positron, proved that Dirac was right. He predicted that there was the electron and the anti-electron. So, the key issue is that the antiparticle has exactly the same mass of the particle, but all opposite charges, the electron, and also the charges I was mentioning that are hidden in the quantum field theory, in the Gates theory. So, what happens? You have a peculiar phenomenon that when an electron and a positron match, they meet. And what they do, they disappear and they produce just energy, gamma rays. Okay? And the reason is that you have the Einstein relation, right? You have the energy stored at the beginning, the electron, the anti-electron, can completely disappear and produce energy under the form of photons. So, well, Anderson showed discovered that the electron had the antiparticle, the antielectron, the positron. But actually, what we see, what we know nowadays, is that all charges, all all particles, okay, have
a correspondent antiparticle.
Okay? So this table actually has two sides. So, for example, there is the electron and there is the positron, the antielectron. There is the proton and there is the antiproton. There is the up quark and there is the anti up quark. And but in some cases, the antiphoton and the antiphotons are the same. This happens with all the Gates bosons.
So, but what is important is that Dirac predicted the existence of antimatter. So, what do we know about these antiparticles? Which I repeat, they are not science fiction. Thanks. These antiparticles.
Okay, we have experimental collider again. Okay, we know, for example, that particles and antiparticles can annihilate, and all are often produced in pairs. So, for example, you have an electron and an antielectron, they can produce a photon. But in some cases, you also have a photon that produces an electron and an antielectron.
Moreover, we know that matter and antimatter behave very similarly. Okay? They have a behavior that, for phenomena, is almost the same. For example, the interaction with photons is exactly the same.
So, this means that imagine that I'm made of antimatter. Okay, just by looking at me, photons, you will never understand if I'm made of matter or antimatter. Clearly, you will discover it if you come here and you ask me, right? Because you're...
Because we'll be at the age.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So, who wants to try? I promise I'm matter. Okay? Actually, the symmetry is such that maybe I don't... Okay.
Doesn't matter.
but only in some few cases you have that matter and antimatter. We have slightly different. But this effect is very, very tiny. So in the rest of the talk, we are going almost to forget it. Okay? But the point is that it's true that in some peculiar processes, antimatter and matter behave a bit different. Okay? And if you're able to discover it, you win the Nobel Prize. But somebody else won the Nobel Prize for that, so you have to discover something different.
Yeah, but I think what's important to make people realize that since we live in a universe of matter, where if normally the symmetry at the Big Bang we will have created...
Well, you're running too fast.
So why are we in the matter world? So this is due to CP violation that there is we are in matter.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
no,
sorry.
No, but they were thanking you because if you reach directly the conclusion, we can go to have lunch and wonder. Okay, so he gave the conclusion of the talk, but let's forget. That's the second comment, and let's go on because we start. Okay, we want to be as empirical as possible. So, okay, you have particle and antiparticle. And in principle, for example, okay, you don't know if I'm made of matter or antimatter, but you can study me. For example, how I jump, what is the gravitational force acting on me, and you check and you discover that there is no difference. The prediction that there is no difference, and moreover, at CERN in 1995. They were able to produce an antihydrogen atom. Okay, this means that an antinucleon of
hydrogen
with the antielectron around. Okay,
in 1995 they produced the first antihydrogen. Since then
they have produced a lot of them. And by checking the properties of this antimatter.
So far, they have discovered that there is no difference.
Oh, are we able to make more complex atoms, that, for example, non-helium?
The answer is that I don't know, the truth is I don't know. But second, I guess it's very, very difficult because, the real answer is that I don't know, but by speaking with people in the bar and the beer, not in the forthcoming future. Okay. Yes, what maybe?
How do we know if it was an anti-grade factor that it behaved as a normal grade factor?
I was sure that giving this kind of talk to you is dangerous. And if you want tomorrow, I can give you my information. But as far as I know, here, I said what they are able to do is to produce also other products. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I guess, but I promise to my child because I'm not doing this stuff, so sorry about that. So I'm quite sure that what they are doing was to use the pre-accelerator to the anti-proton stuff they can produce and to try to bind it to a material. Okay? But if you tomorrow I'm not sure if I will listen. No, let's do something different. No, no other way, the homework is just from later on we check together. And otherwise do it, no?
So at Collider, what we know is that antimatter, as far as we know, looks like matter. In the sense that it behaves very much like matter, and but only some cases you feel a difference. And it's not something of science fiction, because at Collider, you can produce the antimatter many, many times in abundance. But Paris. Okay. So the question is clearly, okay, fine. A collider, we have a lot of antimatter, we can produce a lot of antimatter. So where is antimatter in the sky, in our universe? So there is an experiment. The experiment is NS, and it's in the ISS shuttle. Okay. And it was announced some years ago, and till then they have provided data. And what they are doing, since it's orbiting around the Earth, it's mostly checking the presence of anti-protons around the Earth. And the result is the following. Clearly, there are a lot of antiprotons, I posit, a lot of antiprotons. Clearly, there are also a lot of protons. And there are also a lot of positrons, the antielectrons. And clearly, there are also a lot of electrons. But whenever you find an antiproton or an antielectron, you can understand that it is not something that was produced long time ago, but it is just a process in the universe, around the atmosphere, okay, where you have, for example, a production of a photon producing the pair of electron antielectron. So the issue is that, also in the atmosphere and in the outer space, you have kind of collider, right? You have that there are protons, okay, for example, proton-antiproton colliding, like in the LHC, and producing matter-antimatter. But the real question is, do we have antimatter that comes from the beginning of the universe, not what we are producing like in collider? So far, we see that there is not all the positrons and antiprotons are compatible with stuff that has been produced by the collisions around the Earth. So we conclude that all the annihilations of coming to producing these antiprotons and antiproton and positron are coming from annihilations. So there are no antinuclei. So there are no antibodies close to the Earth. We can check and to try to understand if there is an antimatter in abundance somewhere else in the universe. So we repeat something important, right? Because whenever you have a matter meeting an antimatter, they annihilate and they produce a lot of photons. So now let's try to do a kind of Gedanken experiment
we think. And imagine that you look at the sky, and for some reason, the sky, you have one, you look at the sky, and imagine that in that part of the sky, far away, there is a patch of the sky made of antimatter. Okay? And around, all the rest is matter. So, what do you expect from that?
It's not sticky.
So, if you have, imagine here, I'm made of matter, okay? Oh, sorry, I'm made of antimatter, and here around there is the air, and the air is made of matter, okay? I annihilate with the air. So, whenever matter and antimatter are in contact, they disappear. They disappear, they produce a lot of photons. This means that if in the sky, imagine that in the situation where in the sky you have a patch of antimatter and the rest is matter, what you should see is the border of the patch of antimatter producing a lot of photons. So you should see that.
So there are experiments and measurements, and you don't see it clearly. So you see that, you understand that in practice there is no primordial antimatter in the universe. So what happened to antimatter? So, let's repeat briefly the universe, the history of the universe. So we started, you know, with a hot and dense universe, just after the Big Bang. In this epoch, okay, and just after that, you had a kind of soup of quarks, leptons, and photons, and clearly, also antiparticles. The universe expanded and cooled down. And all the particles, what you can imagine that all the most of the particles, antiparticles that were there at the beginning, met. And this meeting produced a lot of photons. So the original matter, antimatter disappeared. So now, one question. Imagine that you start with a bottle. Yes, you have a glass. Okay, and here you have 100 atoms and 100 antiatoms. They annihilate. So at the end, how many atoms, antiatoms you have? Zero, somebody said, right? Good. So imagine now that you have 10 atoms and 1 antiatoms. In the end, after a while, what do you obtain?
None.
Okay, right? So this example is simple, but it is saying something trivial. In the sense that if today we have only protons, and in the original universe there was protons and protons, the unique explanation to have today just protons is that at the beginning the number of protons was much higher than the number of antiprotons. So there is a technical way to quantify this asymmetry. So the asymmetry is, the asymmetry we have mentioned is the number of baryons minus the number of antibaryons. Baryons is a nice way to cool matter. And okay, and just we need also a normalization, okay, just to compare it. And we compare it to these photons. Okay? So at quantitative level, we have that the baryon, the asymmetry of matter and antimatter is given by this number. The number of baryons minus the number of antibaryons divided by the photons. yes. The point is that leptons are very difficult to count. And the reason is because we have the neutrinos. So leptons is, it would be wonderful to also to have the lepton asymmetry, but in practice you cannot measure it. Because you can measure the lepton, the muon, and so on, but the neutrinos, the number of neutrinos in the universe. Yeah? No, it's such a, okay. So that's the reason because yes. So that is the reason because we are counting, we are using the baryons as an indicator of antimatter and matter. So
they weigh much less, so it's 1,000 times less. So if you count the mass of the universe, counting the environments is sufficient in some sense. It's another way to say the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's a matter of that. Maybe we assume that it's mass. Or we predict that the electrons are much smaller than the
environment. It's a charge. It's a charge. You have the same amount of protons and electrons.
Okay, in my naive understanding, the main issue is exactly that. Okay, actually, there are some people proposing ideas to check the lepton number. Okay, but it's very, that's the reason because, in the end, okay. Again, here I'm trying to have a sloppy conversation, but to have concepts. And sloppy concepts sometimes are dangerous. Okay, so, so we have two possibilities, right? Since we have said that the matter-antimatter asymmetry that we see today must be caused by some asymmetry in a previous stage of the universe. So the point is, how is it possible that there was that asymmetry? So there are two possibilities, right? The first one you say, wow, okay, I give up, I don't want to understand, and I imagine that the universe started with a baryon symmetry. Good. So, fine, I roughly buy it, but the point is that in physics and in general, we would like to understand the origin of the numbers, right? So, it's a bit very unpleasant to have a problem to explain, well, sometimes long ago, I have no idea, but there was a baryon asymmetry, the Big Bang, I don't know. Okay, fine. Maybe the universe also like that, but okay, we don't, as far as possible, if we have a better explanation, we go for the whole camera, right? You're like, okay, close. So, this is one point. And the second point, the point is that there is a second issue that is crucial, and this one is inflation. So, I will speak it about it tomorrow, but, and we have also somebody speaking about inflation in CMB. Okay? But the point is that in order to solve other problems in cosmology, you need an epoch of the universe where a lot of photons were produced. So if at some point you have you started with an initial baryon symmetry, but after that you have a lot of photons, but I'm speaking about like 10 to the 30 photons, okay? So any baryon asymmetry you're putting at the beginning basically goes to zero. Okay? So even in the case that you assume that the universe at the beginning started with the baryon asymmetry, after this period where it is required for many reasons, we see tomorrow. If you have the baryon asymmetry with this period, inflation, that basically put to zero this number. So, two good reasons to say that initial asymmetry, no thanks. If needed, what we want to do is to find a way to predict, at least to explain that number by first principles. So, there was a guy, clever, and this guy understood that in order to generate a baryon asymmetry, You need some ingredients. You need a baryon number violation. Okay? Baryon number is what is a number that corresponds, for example, plus one for a baryon and minus one for an antibaryon. So if you have a baryon asymmetry, this means that the total baryon number of the universe is the number of the baryons minus the number of antibaryons, or if you want, the number of baryons plus the number of the baryonic number of antimatters. This means, in the end, number of baryons minus number of antibaryons. Okay? So, clearly, if you want to start with a universe that has no baryon asymmetry, you need some processes that are violating this baryon number. Processes that make a difference to produce a baryon and antibaryon. Moreover, you need also another issue, which is CP violation. And this CP violation is also an important ingredient. It's technical,
So I will try to give you a sloppy example at glance if you want. Okay, a sloppy explanation. But the point is that we need also CP violation. And what you see, moreover, if you need a thermal a departure for a thermal equilibrium. Also, this one is technical. Basically, it means the same, the following. Okay, I will try to give you a stupid example that I thought in the plane. Okay, so all that, okay, laughter. Maybe it doesn't work. Eh? I'm doubting that. But since we're friends and we are having fun, probably. Okay, we try. So all that was predicted by Sakharov. Okay, in this long ago, and Sakharov. In the period of my life, was a kind of myth, a very nice guy for me. Because typically, you know, okay, physicists sometimes are, okay, they're in the office working, you know, nothing but their impact on social life, you know. But Sakharov, he's the first physicist that I know that had great ideas, because he proved that the baryon, a way to produce a baryon symmetry, and moreover, he had a very social life. And the point that, for example, he was Russian, and he was working at the beginning with the Soviet nuclear nuclear plant. At some point, he decided, maybe this kind of program is dangerous because this Cold War will make only Cold War, yes, between US and yes, no, Cold War, yes, all good. So this kind of development of science is dangerous too. In particular, if this kind of science is used to make bombs. So, for his activity, actually, he's one of the greatest, very wonderful physicists, and he got the Nobel Prize for peace. So, since the time is almost over, okay, tomorrow I'm going to try to answer these questions, right? So the first is we have some ideas, some mechanisms to use the baryon ingredients, these ones, to explain the baryon asymmetry of the universe. So we don't assume that there was a baryon asymmetry at the beginning and forget it. You will never understand how and why. We will see, okay, they're mechanisms, physicists made a mechanism, where you can implement these three ingredients in a theory, and this theory provides you a baryon asymmetry. So there are many possibilities, but tomorrow I'm going to focus one in particular, and this one is due to the fact that maybe the Higgs had the phase transitions in the early universe. So since the topic of the school is also phase transitions, I'm going to speak about that. So, the question is, was the universe boiling at some point? Where by this boiling, I mean that you have a kind of transitions, phase transition, like water, you have bubbles. So in the universe, you have bubbles of some phase, expanding into a different phase, and making process. So, in particular, for the phase transition, the Higgs can have a role. For example, just to some words, maybe you remember first order phase transition and second order phase transition. We'll try to review that. So, in particular, by a bit speculating about this transition, we will try to reproduce the baryon asymmetry. Moreover, the questions are, okay, fine, you're speculating, or yeah, so, fine, but in physics we want predictions. What are the predictions? So, tomorrow, we will try to see also the prediction of this hypothesis. And then, okay, maybe there was not just one phase transition, many phase transitions of the Higgs. And this transition can be related to the baryon asymmetry, but for example, can be related also to Higgs, to the inflation. Okay, so I guess that these are the questions that I hope to address tomorrow. But, so, thanks. That's it. Thank you.